That's New York-born and bred jazz legend Sonny Rollins on tenor sax, heading the Sonny Rollins Quartet on a hard bop number, Strode Road. That's from his 1956 masterpiece album, Saxophone Colossus. Tommy Flanagan on piano, Doug Watkus on bass, Max Roach on drums, and, of course, the sole survivor so far of this quartet is Rollins. He's 84 and still going strong. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Wednesday, August the 20th, and the White House and intelligence agencies have confirmed that a video showing Islamic State extremists beheading American journalist James Foley is authentic. In North St. Louis, about 4 miles from the besieged town of Ferguson, a 23-year-old black man who allegedly tried to rob a convenience store at knife point was shot and killed, reportedly by 2 St. Louis police officers. Witnesses on the scene said the man was pacing back and forth and acting erratically when the police arrived. He didn't drop the knife when he was ordered to, and instead begged police, "Kill me now." Despite reports of a turn in the climate in Ferguson, in terms of clashes between police and protesters, because of the presence, presumably, of the National Guard, Ferguson spent a 10th night since the police killing of Michael Brown in turmoil. About 78 people were arrested, 52 of them from Ferguson and the St. Louis area. U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder is in Ferguson today to oversee the federal autopsy of Michael Brown's body, the progress of FBI and departmental investigations run by the Department of Justice that began last week, and to meet with local leaders. We're following up on our conversation yesterday about troubling legal issues that have already surfaced in the Brown case in Ferguson and the Eric Garner case in Staten Island, New York. Our guest, attorney at war Alton Maddox, the People's Attorney General, as he's properly known, returns for part two. And it's great to have you back, Alton. Happy to have you.
Thanks for the invitation again, Eutrice.
Well, I guess we can title today's discussion the battling grand juries. The question is this really about a zeal for justice? In New York, Staten Island District Attorney Daniel Donovan announced yesterday that he'll convene a special grand jury next month to determine culpability for the July 17th chokehold death of Eric Garner. In Ferguson, St. Louis County prosecuting attorney Bob McCullough has convened a grand jury which begins hearing evidence today on whether Officer Darren Wilson, who on August 9th shot and killed Michael Brown, should be charged with a crime, and if so, what the charge or charges would be. In a statement yesterday on the eve of Holder's arrival in Ferguson, Governor Jay Nixon said, quote, "a vigorous prosecution must now be pursued," unquote. And there are indications that Attorney General Eric Holder himself, having promised a, quote, "fair and thorough investigation," unquote, may include a federal grand jury in that, in the course of those investigations. But let's start with this special grand jury in the Garner case. I know that rings with you, that word special grand jury. People think it's called a special grand jury because, well, you know, it's special. But there's a huge clue here, I think, that the impaneling of a special grand jury is the DA's way of skirting the issue. Special grand juries versus regular grand juries. You've had particular experience with special grand juries in the Brawley case. Could you tell us whether you have any concerns about this appointment of a special grand jury in the Staten Island case?
Let me first repeat something that I think may be very important because you consistently find that people who know zero about the law are consulted, and someone who has a proven track record is simply ignored. And I have no problem being ignored, except that it is costly to our own people. And that's the concern that I have. I have no other concern. I certainly have no interest in being in front of the cameras or anything like that. In the past, in the Brawley case, unfortunately, we used Reverend Al Sharpton for that purpose, along with C. Vernon Mason, which clearly indicated I had no interest in media attention myself, because I think lawyers have to really do the work and not engage in the rhetoric. And so under those circumstances, I found that both of these men, for that purpose, were capable of doing the job. Of course, you know, like anything else, people have one agenda and then they come up with another agenda, and the other agenda sometimes seems more profitable than the original agenda. And so, you know, that's where we are. But having said that, I want to just simply repeat that I happen to be, unfortunately, the only attorney in the United States who has ever secured a special prosecutor in not only one racially motivated case, but in two racially motivated cases. And there's another process in which that is done, and it's not a simple process, as many of us have a tendency to engage in, and that is oversimplifying any issue. There's a lot that is involved. I hope that anybody that's listening to this broadcast will not become guilty of oversimplifying it. I do want to start by saying first, before we actually talk about the special grand jury in quotation marks, I would like to first focus on the prosecutors themselves, and particularly the prosecutor in Ferguson, Missouri, because I do believe that there is no way that you can get a fair hearing unless you have a fair and impartial prosecutor. And most of these prosecutors will not recuse themselves, which demonstrates their own bad faith. But if you want to start with Bob McCullough in St. Louis, Missouri, for example, I would simply point this out to the people of St. Louis and Ferguson, Missouri. and that is this. Most states have statutes on how you challenge for cause potential jurors. And one of the particular grounds for challenging a person for cause is that the person cannot be fair, or there's some relationship between the person and one of the parties in the case which creates a conflict of interest. Now, Bob McCollum, and we know this just based on his ground, his background, had a father who was a police officer and was gunned down by allegedly a black man, and he had other members of his family that are in law enforcement. Now, if McCollum came to a courtroom as a potential juror, he would not be permitted to sit on the jury because any competent lawyer would bring out his background, and the judge, on his own motion, would dismiss McCollum because there is clearly a cloud over him, and therefore he would not be permitted to sit as a juror. Now, if a person is unable to sit as a juror in a case, I would like for someone to explain to me how he can become the prosecutor in that same case. And so I say this because there are several lawyers in Ferguson right now, and they seem to be posturing more for the cameras than they are for the opportunity to get into a courtroom. And if they did get into a courtroom, there were certain applications that they would make before the court that would clarify some of these issues and possibly minimize the level of violence that is reportedly taking place in Ferguson, Missouri. So one of the real culprits here is not the people who are throwing Molotov cocktails, but are the black attorneys who refuse to do their jobs and, in the words of Charles Hamilton Houston, have chosen to become social parasites.
Well, you put the cart before the horse. We were going to get to Ferguson, but in as much as you started there, let's continue there, and we'll come back to Staten Island afterwards. If investigations are still ongoing with three, not just one, but three autopsy reports in play, how solid will a grand jury process be?
Well, I think that, first of all, we have to realize the grounds for arrest under the Fourth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution is simply that of probable cause. Probable cause means that a crime has been committed, and we know now from the autopsy reports that the manner of death was homicide, and we also the name of the person who caused the death of Michael Brown. Under those circumstances, there is no reason for the prosecutor at this stage to have this man at large and in liberty. He should be behind bars. The mere fact that he is not behind bars is a clear signal to the grand jury that there is nothing that the state of Missouri is interested in doing to him, and so therefore why should members of the grand jury do the same? This is the same ground that exists here in Staten Island, because here for more than a month, there's been an autopsy report which it clearly indicated that the manner of death was homicide, and the name of the police officer has been known for quite some time, and yet no action has been taken. Now, in New York, this is grounds for the governor of the state of New York to immediately remove this prosecutor here in New York on the grounds that he is guilty of obstruction of justice. Obstruction of justice means that when justice is delayed, it is also denied. And the fact that he has been at large and at liberty for a month without anybody laying a glove on him is clearly evidence of obstruction of justice. And at this particular point, it is the governor of the state of New York, as well as in Missouri, the governor of Missouri, to make sure that the laws are faithfully executed. That's their oath. That's what they're required to do. And they have not done that. And obviously some lawyers should be out in Missouri as well as here in New York filing writ of mandamuses against both prosecutors.
Well, let's go back again. I'm ping-ponging back and forth with you. I'm keeping pace with you. In the Staten Island case where the DA says he's going to call a special grand jury, does he, as a DA, have the authority to call a special grand jury, or does that come under the purview of the Attorney General?
You're absolutely right. He absolutely had no authority to call a special grand jury. The term would only apply to him if he was a special prosecutor. He is not. He is treating this as a garden variety case in Staten Island. There is nothing exactly that attaches anything special to this case, and he is perpetrating fraud by using the wrong terms.
I remember this was research that I did during the Brawley case with the appointment of the so-called special prosecutor who ended up putting together a kind of a mishmash of a special grand jury. But in any event, special grand juries, according to the research that I remember doing, tend to write reports, and they tend to issue findings relating to official misconduct and criminality and corruption in government and that kind of thing. Special grand juries are rarely ever used in homicide cases. Does that bother you?
Well, you know, I think you're absolutely right that in a particular case, like this, what bothers me is the fact that the prosecutor has not even attempted to support the idea that there would be a grand jury report of this matter, that it is of such magnitude that the legislature should also be put on notice as to what really occurred. And that's why you have the grand jury reports, to make specific legislative recommendations to the legislature and to make sure that those laws are particularly tightened up. Now, as it relates to the Brawley case, and this is something that a lot of people don't realize, because when it got to Trayvon Martin, they still didn't realize this, is that if you are an elected prosecutor, you cannot be a special prosecutor. And so you had Bob Abrams trying to claim that he was a special prosecutor. And under the law, he should have been a special prosecutor, but he refused to undertake his job as a special prosecutor. And that's the reason why there was a conflict in the Brawley case, because he refused to exercise his duties as a special prosecutor, and he sought to delegate that authority to Jack Ryan, who had not been appointed by Governor Cuomo to be the special prosecutor. And we demanded it's either Jack Ryan or you, but only one of you can be the special prosecutor, and that must be on record. And he refused to do that, and that was the breakdown in the Brawley case before he ever got started.
Now, inasmuch as the Staten Island DA has decided he's going to convene a special grand jury, which we agree is usually looking into matters of public policy and corruption, and it usually is charged with writing a report as opposed to issuing the indictments and so forth, does this mean that the DA is considering the Garner case less a question of homicide and more a question of public policy?
Well, the DA, in my humble opinion, is not considering either. In my humble opinion, the DA is influenced by the PBA itself. And this is the same concern that elected officials otherwise have, and this is the same concern that attorneys have. And I've tried to tell this to people right here in New York for 24 years, that I have never been disciplined by a disciplinary committee. The courtroom was open. People came and had an opportunity to witness something, but they did not witness that because a disciplinary committee starts with the complainant. It starts with the person who is making the complaint. Nobody ever made a complaint I stole money or I did anything wrong. And the only complaint that I got was from the New York legislature, which is on file. I mean, so anybody want to understand this process, you can't go by what people tell you. You got to go by what the facts are. And so it's been hard for me just to get the black folks to look at the public record and try to glean from the public record what really has taken place. And so here in Staten Island, because the PBA can get rid of a defense attorney, they also can, get, obviously in New York, get rid of a prosecutor. And this is the concern that Donovan has in Staten Island.
Well, in as much as he has made this public, in as much as he has decided this is what he will do, and there is no guidance or opposition from the state to say, well, wait a minute, you can't by yourself, you just can't, you know, appoint a special grand jury. That's not within your purview. That's not within your authority. But we're not hearing any opposition to any of this.
We're not hearing any opposition, not only from the state, but we're not hearing opposition from the public. And that's the reason why I said all along that before black folks consider marching or a caravan or a motor charade, the first thing they need to do is learn the law. You know, I mean, you go to a whole convention, hold some forum where you actually learn the law. Because if you don't know the law, you don't know your rights. So what is the purpose of you doing riding over from Brooklyn to Staten Island when you have nothing in your head that would direct you what you should do once you get in Staten Island?
So right away, we have this case taking a very odd turn. We have a case that if there's going to be a grand jury, let it be a grand jury. But to now decide that this case is going to be a special grand jury, which normally does not have this function and which normally is not called by the DA, it is usually called by the Attorney General. Mm-hmm. And we don't have any indication that the Attorney General of the state of New York has ordered a special grand jury into this matter. We see that the special grand jury is usually about policy. It's usually about looking at systemic problems and systemic corruption and systemic wrongdoing. But if that is, in fact, the general purview of a special grand jury to look at these kinds of administrative wrongdoings and governmental issues, what does it say about the DA? The DA is saying, in effect, I do not consider this a murder case. I don't consider this a homicide case. I consider the role of the grand jury here to write a report, which is what special grand juries are for. They do that. They write reports on their findings with the aim of making recommendations to the state legislature in order to, you know, improve whatever it is they find is wrong. But once he has made that decision, and that is, we agree, is a questionable decision, now comes a question of, was the intent then to skirt the regular process of impaneling a grand jury that will focus on the charge of homicide as opposed to administrative problems?
Well, the answer to that is very simple, and that is this. This becomes a matter of public concern, and this is the reason why we get so confused, because we elevate the victim over the public. It is not, the victim only comes into a matter after the fact. The victim was never involved in any of these cases. The victim never said anything. The victim was just simply out there who became harmed, and as a result of becoming harmed, has incurred a cause of action, a private cause of action. But the public cause of action is still being unaddressed. And so there has to be some spokesperson for the public, somebody who knows the law, not some media hound or somebody who's trying to increase ratings for MSNBC, but somebody who really know what they're supposed to be doing. And this is where the problem is in this city, and certainly in Ferguson, unfortunately there, the people have had to take to the streets of Ferguson because of the fact that they obviously don't have any legal representation there at all. And so, therefore, they have no other way of expressing themselves than through violence. Because one thing we have to understand is very simple. White men are bilingual. Let me put it that way. White men are bilingual. They only understand two languages. One is the language of the law. The second is the language of violence. Sometimes they only take attention to the language of violence. Sometimes even the language of the law doesn't amount to a hill of beans. But you got to at least know the language of the law before you can even get their attention. If you don't know the language of the law, you're absolutely whistling in the wind. And that's what our people got to understand. These people don't understand anything else. And so, you know, what we are doing here is running around following a Judas goat. The last time I checked, when he got in trouble, he had to consult me. And I had to not only represent him, but represent him pro bono and spend hundreds of thousands of dollars of my money in order to save him. Now, if that's not a nut case, I don't know what is.
Are you the nut, though? That's the question.
No, I'm not the nut. No, I'm not the nut. Those people who will be riding cars over the Verrazano Narrows Bridge on Saturday.
So, in as much as this has happened, in as much as this is now his declared intention, and we see right from the start, right now, it is official that this case is destined to be taken off the track and be given a big puff piece in the eyes of the public. Oh, I'm calling a special grand jury. And people thinking, oh, great, that is fantastic. It means you're taking this case seriously without understanding that there are special restrictions and special rules applying to a special grand jury. And so, to my mind, the case is already set up to be derailed. And I wonder, from your point of view, what is the legal remedy at this point, at the instant that we spotting this thing going wrong?
Well, you know, the first thing I did in the Trayvon Martin case, and I guarantee you, the only legal document that was ever filed in that courthouse on this issue was the one that I wrote. And I told the prosecutor then, you are not a special prosecutor. You are an elected official. Don't call yourself that. That's what the confusion is, because our people don't know the law, and they believe everything you say. And so, you know, that's where we are again. You have somebody who spews something out, and the rest of us just believe it, not knowing or not being concerned about what the real facts are. The reality of it is incumbent upon the governor of the state of New York to write a document saying that so-and-so has been appointed and these are his powers. That is his requirement to do. You cannot allow this to be a garden and variety type case. And so that's what we did in Howard Beach. That's what we even did in Tawana Brawley. I mean, after that, Abrams forfeited his duties. He didn't want to be a special prosecutor, but we did all of that. And, you know, and so here we are again. We haven't gotten off home plate yet. you know, in terms of dealing with these issues, and we're already being derailed.
Another thing about special grand juries is they can take their time, as much time as they wish, and there's nothing anybody could do about it.
That's absolutely correct, and that's why they took nearly a year, a long period of time, in the Brawley case, because they can absolutely do that. Unfortunately, in the Brawley case, it was Abrams and not the grand jury that wrote the grand jury report, which is
that's
another
true.
Violation of law. And we presented this to the courts, showing that jurors on the grand jury said they didn't write this. This was Abrams saying this. The word hoax was his word, not their word. Their position was Abrams had not proven anything. They didn't know no more at the end of the case than they did at the beginning of the case. And therefore, they had no reason to say that this was a hoax. When we went through trial in Poughkeepsie on a defamation case, the longest civil trial in the history of New York State, the petit jury, not the grand jury then, the petit jury said, well, we know that something happened to Tawana, and we know that as it relates to Maddox, he did not defame Pagonis because Pagonis was involved as one of the attackers. I'm not saying what, you know, I want to say. I'm saying what's in the jury verdict, and a copy of that verdict sheet is at the Freedom Party headquarters. I got two compiled books on that. So anybody who want to see what the jury said, they can go there and see that. Our problem is we got to stop listening to people and start doing the research. And the research starts with an inspection of the public record.
And even as he's contemplating impaneling this special grand jury, one of the key witnesses is out of circulation. Could you comment about that?
Well, yeah, I mean, and this is a sad commentary, Utrice. And I'm going to tell you this. When I, announced on your program, I'll go back into the practice of law, my idea was to prepare a motion to intervene to follow the New York Times, which has also filed a motion to intervene, because the New York Times has said, well, we don't know what happened. Tell us what this is all about. I'm saying I want to intervene not only to know what happened, but I want to intervene to litigate on behalf of the untold number of black and Latino men who were unlawfully and falsely arrested. This is a class, and I want to mount a class action so that they also can have access to the court. Now, since that time, I have been able to raise a few dollars, and these few dollars now have been dissipated because I'm now trying to go back and deal with Eric Garner. I'm also now having to pay for Tawana Brawley in her matters because she can't get a job. She has a daughter to support, and she has no income. So, you know, what I'm saying is this is crazy. And if for me now to be trying to raise some ransom for Ramsey Order, it's crazy. And for the black community to sit up on their thumbs and act like justice is free. I mean, it's the craziest thing that I have ever seen. At the same time, where I do want to compliment the people of Ferguson, because you see, justice starts at the top and goes to the bottom. You can't come into Ferguson and claim the people that got Molotov cocktails for the problem. The problem starts with the governor of the state of Missouri. He has the constitutional obligation to make sure that the laws are fairly and faithfully executed. The next person is Bob McCullough, who is the St. Louis attorney. That's where you start with justice. You don't start with the people that you may have caught throwing a Molotov cocktail as how disfavorable that might be. And some people, you know, may adhere to the theory of nonviolence and see this as offensive. However, the real culprit is the governor of Missouri, and the second in command is Bob McCullough, who is the St. Louis district attorney.
Well, with regard to McCullough, there's a question I have. he has announced, and in fact, supposedly today, they began presenting evidence to a grand jury. And I'm amazed that we are not hearing any concerns from the attorneys representing the family as to the makeup of the grand jury, considering the racial division that has been historically the case in Ferguson. Well, where are you drawing your jury pool from? Considering that the apparatus of policing in that town and law enforcement and prosecution is almost all white in an almost all black town, these things would tend to concern me if I were an attorney representing the deceased. And I would raise these questions to argue again that McCullough should not be handling this case, that it ought to be a special prosecutor here. But we haven't heard anything except that, you know, justice, they want justice, whatever that means. So what are your concerns about that?
Well, I think you're absolutely hitting the nail on the head, and I want everybody to clean out their ears and hear this. Because sometimes, you know, I may not get another chance to say it, because censorship is in effect in New York City without dissent. And so I am saying this. Tawana Brawley had many legal significances. And one of them is that we not only were able to get the second special prosecutor in a racially motivated case, but in addition to that, this was the first time where we forced Abrams to waive the secrecy requirements of a grand jury and to pick the grand jury in the open. Now, that's what happened on the first day. That's a matter of public record. The grand jury that was assigned to hear this case, or the jury pool from which the grand jury would be impaneled, were people who had to testify in open public as to their qualifications, so that all of us can look at those backgrounds and to see whether they met those requirements or not. So it is not an ironclad rule that a grand jury has to be secret. It is not an ironclad rule, and it did not happen in Tawana Brawley. Those jurors were examined in the public, and everybody understood who they were. The same thing has to happen in Richmond County. Those grand jurors have to be examined in the open. But as you say, there are other issues that got to go around or surround the selection or the impoundment of a grand jury, and this is just one of those requirements. But my point is, there's legal precedent now from Tawana Brawley's case to waiving the secrecy requirements of a grand jury and requiring the potential grand jurors to be testify in public.
Well, if people listening are keeping track, they would understand that these are very, very serious questions, and it is all the more mind-boggling that there's no legal challenge coming from the people representing the deceased,
right,
on these matters, and yet they are so inextricably linked to whatever it is that they say is justice. If you want justice, you have to be on top of these things. You have to make these things known. And if you're going to be talking to the community, and instead of talking about, well, we need you to show up for this demonstration, or we need you to march across this bridge, or we need you to do this or do that, what about, we need you to understand what the legal issues are here, and we need you to help us fight this case. We need you to understand where we are. We are fighting and representing our client, who is deceased, can't speak for himself, but we certainly have an obligation to make sure that that happens, rather than say, well, we leave that up to the system, the same system that is responsible for the deaths of these two men. We leave it up to them to do the right thing, and we will concentrate instead on the civil settlement that is inevitable.
No, you're absolutely right, Yatrice. And again, because, see, this is really a classroom discussion that we're actually conducting here. And it only points out that you can't simplify these matters. I mean, the things that have taken place in the past may have been simple to the public, but they were certainly not simple to those attorneys who had to unravel all of the knots and get a case on track. Now, having said that, it is important to understand that the family of the deceased can have an estate, and the estate has the standing to sue anyone that's responsible for the harm that may have come to the victim, including death. On the other hand, the family can hire an ambulance chaser in order to do that. And an ambulance chaser is an attorney who elevates hush money over justice. And so the issue of justice still remains. Like, for example, in Eric Garner, the issue of justice still remains there because an ambulance chaser has come in based on the rights of the family to get what he can for the family. He's not interested in justice. However, there is a public cause of action that exists because anytime that you perpetrate a crime, it is a public act also. And so if you, at that point, you need somebody to represent the public. And we have no representation. That's the problem. No, Al Sharpton can't represent nobody, including himself. He can't speak the legal language. He doesn't know the legal language. He doesn't know anything about law. He's never been in a law school. His question was, he ever been in a college? You know, I mean, his question was, he ever graduated from high school? I mean, but to now, all of a sudden, you don't say, well, Sharpton is representing us. I mean, this is lunacy. And only a fool would believe that. And so that's where we are. We are left without any representation, and they are going forward because they know no representation exists. And the end result will be the same thing as it happened in Trayvon Martin, will be the same thing happening in Sean Bell, will be the same thing happening in Amadou Diallo. And that is no justice with peace.
Let me ask you now about the third element here, and that is U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder, presumably, or maybe be conjecturing by saying so, that there would be some kind of a federal grand jury. What possibly could come out of a federal grand jury? If supposing one were appointed, what would the contribution be there?
Well, let me go back, because that's another great question. And really that question should have already been been on the road to be answered. You see, there's a case called Monroe versus Pope that was decided by the U.S. Supreme Court in 1961. And which basically really forbid people from going into federal court seeking relief under Title 42, Section 1983 of the U.S. Code. And so the problem is that Monell versus Department of Social Services is a case in which, in some extent, overruled Monroe versus Pope, but it placed limitations on the courts to handle 1983 actions, and one of those limitations is that the plaintiff had to show that the complaint arose out of a official policy, and so if the person could not show that the defendant was hiding behind and exercising an official policy that had done harm to an aggrieved person, then you could not go into federal court and to seek any relief. However, what happened was the Supreme Court overruled that and said, well, if you show official policy, then, you know, we may have another ball game here. Now, we don't have to go beyond official policy here because, you see, what people have not discussed is that there is an official shoot-to-kill policy in the United States, and it's in every jurisdiction of the United States. All right, and that official policy is in existence for a couple of reasons, two very outstanding reasons. The first reason is that a wrongful death statute does not usually give benefit to black defenders, because black defenders mostly have no economic value. And so a wrongful death statute requires that the plaintiff show that there is somebody who is still here that would have benefited from the presence of the deceased in the case of a deceased, and that no longer exists. So what has happened throughout the United States, barring no jurisdiction, every jurisdiction has now enacted a shoot-to-kill policy. This is the reason why there were six shots in the case of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, because the police officer had been taught in training, in secret training, that when you get a person, use multiple shots to bring that person down. Now, what happened was is that beforehand, police officers were using 38 revolvers. Now they're using 9 millimeters because the 9 millimeter is more capable of doing the harm that is necessary to protect the police officer from the victim, who is now dead and can't testify against the police officer. So now you got that situation. So, you know, this is the problem that Holder is facing. This is the problem that the attorneys out there in Ferguson right now should have already been on. They should have already filed a 1983 action against the Ferguson Police Department, and Eric Holder should be out in there now announcing that the Justice Department will intervene on behalf of the citizens of Ferguson in order to convict this particular cop. So that's the real process. Now, this goes back to a case called United States versus Rizzo. And that case came out of Philadelphia, you know. And so, you know, you're dealing with these things. Now, I want everybody to understand, I have not practiced law for 24 years. And in that 24 years, I have not had any legal literature to keep me up to date on what really is happening out here. So, you know, when I start talking about I want to help black people, I can't help black people. I don't have any startup costs. It costs money to represent people. You know, it costs money to represent Al Sharpton. It costs money to represent Central Park 7. It costs money to represent Tawana Broad. It costs money to represent the family Yusef Hawkins. It costs money to represent Howard B. All of these cases, I did them all for free. Not only did I do them for free, but I spent the money out of my own pocket to do them. I didn't ask black people in New York for a dime, and nobody gave me a dime. There was never a defense fund that was ever established for me to benefit from. And so this is what we are talking about now. You know, there's a lot of work to be done. There's a tremendous amount of issues that need to be addressed. But you got to first have some legal literature and some legal tools in order to get busy. And you do not chomp yourself off by participating in a charade over the Verrazano Narrows Bridge on this coming Saturday.
Well, I want to stay with one last question about Eric Holder. Of course, Eric Holder, and I happen to be the only reporter in the room when a group of African chiefs went to the Justice Department to discuss the justice, in fact, in the Amadou Diallo case. And we recall that nothing came out of the Justice Department. All four officers walked. In fact, they were able to escape a trial in the city of New York. They were able to secure a trial in Albany before a judge of a judge of their choosing, a judge
judge of Governor Pataki's choosing, and he orchestrated the whole move outside of New York.
And so nothing came out of that case. In his involvement in this case, which is, of course, weighted with a lot of political, there's a lot of political baggage riding on this for the president and for him as well. But I want to ask, even if he were to secure an indictment, would it be on civil grounds or would it be on criminal grounds?
Well, you know, like I said before, the big question is if. Before we get to any ground that he will be pursuing, the big question is if. And to that big question, I want to resolve that if question by saying that black lawyers in Missouri who are practicing there already and some who are visiting Missouri should get busy because they have to take the bull by the horns. I mean, that's just what is going on here. You know, the government of the United States is still honoring the compromise of 1877, and they have continued to do that. And that particular compromise has also reached me because I was also in violation of the compromise of 1877, which was set up by Hayes and Governor Tilden of New York. And so, you know, and Obama, even though it's 1877, he is reminded every day that there's a compromise of 1877 which says that black people can no longer receive and enjoy any federal protection. And that's what he's honoring. And we need to be honest and clear about this. Obama needs to just get before the public and say, look, my hands are tied. There's a compromise in 1877. Unless and until Congress and this country decides to relax that compromise, I don't need to be out here playing games and double-talking with my own people and anybody else who's interested in justice.
You are having a community meeting tonight. What are you going to be talking about?
Well, I tell you, you know, I'm glad you mentioned that, Eutrice, because I hope that the meeting tonight will be an extension of what we are talking about. And I will say that I will be present to give out the elements of a protracted struggle. You see, if you fail to plan, you plan to fail. If you fail to plan, you plan to fail. That doesn't say anything about marching and hooping and hollering and running across the Verrazano Narrows Bridge in a charade. It means that you have to get down with a blueprint. And you don't follow a Judas goat who does not know how to draft one and who has never been an architect. And so tonight we will be addressing that at the Brooklyn Christian Center, 1061 Atlantic Avenue between Clarkson and Franklin in Brooklyn. Take the C train to Franklin Avenue. And I'll say this, you know, there's going to be a lot of lectures. Not a lot of lectures, but they'll be very seldom on these issues. And I can tell you this. If you were in law school or if you were in the practice of law, you would not lose any time by being at 1061 Atlantic Avenue tonight. And I will pass out material, and we will discuss some things way beyond what we have discussed already here, Eutrice, because I tell you, there are so many issues here that our people need to be in sync with before we decide to go anywhere.
How is the fund effort going in behalf of Ramsey Orta?
Well, I tell you, the other day I got a shock of my life. And since then, I haven't heard from any member of the Freedom Party as to giving me an update on any matter relating to the bail fund. I hope that they are just embarrassed and refuse to give me a call because they fear that I may take a leap off the Empire State Building. But right now, until I hear from them, I can only presume that things are not going good. Now, the sad part about that is that I have gotten an offer from Occupy Wall Street in which they said they would help. But it's a sad commentary for a race of over 2 million Africans right here in New York City not to raise $75,000. That's a sad commentary. And we need to get beyond other people having to finance our struggle. That's what happened during the Civil Rights Movement. We didn't finance the Civil Rights Movement. White folks did. When are we going to ever decide that the few pennies that we can spend on toys that we ought to spend on something for real? We need to grow up. And I can tell you this, if that money is not there by 4 o'clock or whenever Carver Federal Savings Bank closed today, you know, I'm going to be very disturbed to think that you have spent all this time representing so many people pro bono that affect everybody's life. There's not a person in New York City that has not been affected by something that I have done. That's not even debatable. And for me to be in a situation where we can't even raise chump's change, given the fact we're over 2 million Africans right here in New York, is absolute disgrace. And I know that not only is Marcus Garvey turning over his grave, but Sonny Carson is also turning over in his grave because he was the one that advised me some time ago never to deal with Al Sharpton under any circumstances.
What number can people call if they wish to contribute?
Well, they need to call immediately, and they need to, after that, start head for the hills, and that is Carver Federal Savings Bank in 3 of the branches here in New York City, and that is Freedom Party, 917-947-8994. That's 917-947-8994. And the phone needs to be ringing off the hook right now, because I tell you, I'm going to be very disappointed to know that I've spent 40-some years in a town where I gave up a law practice to represent black people free and were very successful in doing it. And now we can't even come up with a chump change to get Ramsey Order out of jail, and I'm going to have to rely on white people in order to do that. Now, that is extremely disgraceful to every breathing soul in New York City.
Well, this brings us to the end of the program today, and I want to thank you for shedding light. You are direct, and you're not holding back at all. And this is a question, I mean, you're talking here to a mature audience, and people would probably be a little bit singed by the frankness with which you speak. But, of course, you're talking in the context of struggle and what people have to do. And this is, you know, the lessons learned all over the years. You must take responsibility for your own struggle. There's no, that you cannot expect anybody to do it for you. And it's good when it comes. I mean, if help comes and people contribute, that's fine. But it is your responsibility to do that. Thanks so much, Alton, for being with us today.
Thank you very much for the invitation, Patrice. Thank you very much. And I'll keep you updated on where Ramsey Order is in terms of freeing him from the New York City Department of Correction. I hope that would have happened. He would be with us tonight. But we, as they say, the struggle still continues.
Thank you. Stay tuned. Keep it right here. Coming up next is Alternative Visions with Jack Rasmus. Write me. Let me know how these programs are resonating with you. LeadStories@gmail.com or on Facebook, Lead Stories with Utrice Lead. A pleasure and a privilege to be in your company.